Stories are where I live. They are physical, three-dimensional places to me. When I was a kid and locked in the coal hole for various crimes, I had a choice. Count coal, a limited activity. Tell myself a story, an unlimited world of the imagination. I write for the delight of it, sitting down at a keyboard to play. Christmas has a special delight, as though the season is cheering you on. It's time for tales, presided over by the Lord of Misrule, who must be the guardian spirit of creativity as he is of the ancient 12 days of Christmastide. And strangely, in a house that was generally unhappy, Christmas was a happy time for me when I was growing up. We don't lose these associations. The past comes with us, and with luck, we reinvent it, which is what I am suggesting we do with Christmas. And everything is a story. Stories around the fire at Christmas or told with frosty breath or on a wintry walk have a magic and a mystery that is a part of the season. Writing is an epiphany of its own in the sense of something unexpected being revealed. Christmas, which seems so familiar, maybe even worn out, is a celebration of the unexpected. Here are the stories I have written so far, 12 of them, for the 12 days of the season. Here are ghost stories, magical interventions, ordinary encounters that turn out to be not ordinary at all, small miracles, and salutes to the coming of the light and joy. So opens Christmas Days, 12 stories and 12 feasts for 12 days by Jeanette Winterson. It's Christmas time, a time for television networks to serve up old classics and new movies about the joys and travails of the season, a time for the big screen to feature a slew of movies to tempt us all, Christmas time aficionados and not, to visit our local movie theaters. It's a time for Debbie McComber to publish a new Christmas story, not this one, a time for Ann Perry to add a mystery tale set in December of yesteryear. A time for children's book authors to let their imaginations run wild. And this year, a time for the public of Jeanette Winterson's first collection of Christmas-themed stories, as she told us, 12 of them to suit the 12 days of Christmas. If you kind of know that name, Jeanette Winterson, it's because she is a British author who has penned several books, including her first one, which became a bestseller, Orange is Not the Only Fruit. Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? Sexing the Cherry and The Passion. She's won many prizes, including the E.M. Forrester Award, the Stonewall Award, and the Whitebread Award for Best First Novel. And now she's out with this bang-up collection of Christmas stories. There's a thoughtful approach to an appreciation for this ancient holiday, and indeed, in her opening pages, Winterson takes us to the ancient origins of Christmas, the pre-Christian, then early Christian, then modern-day celebrations that make this such a special time in our year. There's humor here. There's lots of humor. And, most delightful and most moving all, there are memories here. Memories of Winterson's less than wonderful childhood that pop up as moments of reflection on life, on religion, on love. As she writes in her very last story, which seems to be as much a true story as not, Christmas greetings from the author, time is a boomerang, not an arrow. I was adopted by Pentecostals and stamped missionary. Christmas was important in the missionary calendar from the beginning of November. Either we were preparing packages to send to the foreign field, or we were preparing packages to deliver those in hot places, returning to the home front. It might have been because my parents had been in World War II. It might have been because we lived in end time, waiting for Armageddon. Whatever the reason, there was a drill to Christmas, from making the mincemeat for the mince pies to singing carols to, or rather at, the unsaved. Still, my mother loved Christmas. It was the one time of year when she went out into the world looking as though the world was more than a veil of tears. She was an unhappy woman, and so this happy time in our house was precious. I am sure I love Christmas because she did. After I had left home and later gone to university at Oxford, I went back to the old house that first Christmas time. As I reached our little terraced house at the top of the street, I could hear the mostly musical sounds of what is best described as a bossa nova version of In the Bleak Midwinter. My mother had thrown out the old upright piano and got herself an electronic organ with double keyboard, orchestra stops, drum, and bass. She hadn't seen me for quite a long time. Nothing was said. We spent the next hour admiring the effects of snare drum and trumpet solo on Hark the Herald Angels Sing. My Oxford friend from St. Lucia was due to visit me at home, which was brave of her, but when I had tried to explain about my family, she thought I was exaggerating. At first, the visit was a great success. My mother considered a black friend as a missionary endeavor all of its own. She went round to the retired missionaries from the church and asked, "What do they eat?" "Pineapples," came the answer. So when my friend Vicky arrived, my mother gave her a wool blanket she had knitted so that Vicky would not be cold. "They feel very cold," she told me. My mother was an obsessive, and she had been knitting for Jesus all year. The Christmas tree had knitted decorations on it, and the dog was imprisoned inside a Christmas coat of red wool with white snowflakes. There was a knitted nativity scene, and the shepherds were wearing little scarves because this was Bethlehem on the bus route. My dad opened the door dressed in a knitted waistcoat and a matching knitted tie. The whole house had been re-knitted. Mother was in a merry mood. "Would you like some gammon and pineapple, Vicky? Cheese on toast with pineapple? Pineapples and cream? Pineapples upside down cape? Pineapple fritters?" Eventually, after a few days of this fare, Vicky said, "I don't like pineapple." My mother's mood changed at once. She didn't speak to us for the rest of the day, and she crushed up a papier-mâché robin. The next morning at breakfast, the table was set with a pyramid of unopened tins of pineapple chunks and a Victorian postcard of two cats on their hind legs, dressed up like Mr. and Mrs. The caption said, "Nobody loves us." That night when Vicky went to bed, she found that her pillow had been taken out of its pillowcase and the pillowcase stuffed with warning leaflets about the apocalypse. She wondered whether to go home. But I'd seen worse and I thought things might improve. On Christmas Eve, we had a group of carol singers round from the church. My mom did seem happier. She had forced me and Vicky to wrap up several half cabbages in tinfoil and spear them with cocktail sticks of cheddar cheese topped with the rejected pineapple chunks. She called these things Sputniks. It was something to do with the Cold War. Tinfoil and tenne, the scaremongering that the KGB and listening devices hidden in cheese. Never mind, the offending pineapples had found a purpose. And we were all singing carols quite happily. This was remarkable. It was Christmas time. This is a quirky, at times spooky collection of Christmas stories, spooky in so many ways, but as weird, as creepy, as outrageous as the tale or the true story before us may be. And oftentimes, you're never quite sure, like that tale that I just told you. I'm not quite sure how much of that is accurate, how much of that is made up. Doesn't matter. It's part of the story that is told to us in this collection. It's Christmas, and that is celebrated. The opening story is As Good as They Come, and that's pretty darn good. Here's a bit of that tale of a Christmas fantasy dream. Or is it a tale of Christmas that is as true as they come? The street was completely empty now. And you took us backwards, the engine whining under the weight of the effort, until we were outside Bye Bye Baby, the world's biggest department store, finally and reluctantly closed from midnight Christmas Eve for an entire 24 hours, online shopping always available. I got out of the car. The front window of Bye Bye Baby had been arranged as a nativity scene, complete with Mary and Joseph in ski wear, and a number of farm animals keeping warm under tartan dog coats. There was no gold, frankincense, or myrrh. These three kings had brought their presents from BBB. Jesus was getting an Xbox, a bike, and an apartment-friendly drum kit. His mother Mary had been given a steam iron. Flitting about in front of the nativity, her nose pressed inside the window, was a tiny child. "What are you doing in there?" I said. "Trapped," said the child. I went back to the car and tapped on your window. "There's a child left behind in the shop. We've got to get her out." You came and had a look. The child waved. You looked doubtful. She probably belongs to the security guard, you said. She says she's trapped. Call the police. The child smiled and shook her head as you took out your phone. There was something about her smile. I felt uncertain. Who are you? I said. I am the spirit of Christmas. I heard her clearly. She spoke clearly. We looked up and down the strangely deserted street. I was starting to panic. I pulled and pushed at the doors to the store, locked. No cleaners, no janitors. This was Christmas Eve. Then the voice came again. I am the spirit of Christmas. Oh, come on, you said. It's a publicity stunt. But I wasn't listening to you. I was fixed on the face in the window, which seemed to change every second as though the light was playing on it, shrouding, then revealing the expression. The eyes were not the eyes of a child. She is our responsibility, I said quietly. Not really to you. She is not, you said. Come on. I'll call the police as we drive. Let me out, said the child as you turned back toward the car. We'll send someone, I promise. We're going to find a phone. The child interrupted. You must let me out. Will you leave some of your gifts, some of your food in the doorway just there? You turned back. This is crazy. But the child was hypnotizing me. Yes, I said, and half-dazed I went to the car and flipped up the back and started digging wrapped shapes and bags of food towards the doorway of the department store. Every time I put something down, you picked it up again and put it back in the car. You've gone mad, you said. This is a Christmas stunt. We're being filmed. I know it. It's reality TV. No, this isn't reality TV. This is real, I said. My voice sounded far away. This isn't what we know. It isn't what we don't know, but it's true. I'm telling you, it's true. All right, you said, if this is what it takes to get back on the road, here's the bags, okay? Here and here. You slammed them down the doorway, your face flushed with tiredness and exasperation. I know that face. And you stood back, hands and fists, not even thinking about the child. Suddenly, all the lights went out in the window of the store. And then the child was standing in between us on the street. Your face changed. You put your hand on the smooth glass, as clear and closed as a dream. Are we dreaming? You said to me. How did she do that? I'm coming with you, said the child. Where are you going? And what about the hauntingly eerie tale of Christmas told by a narrator who visits friends and old rambling house one December day? A Christmas story with ghosts, a decrepit graveyard, and a family story almost too gruesome to believe. But is it fiction? Or isn't it? Or how about the true story of our author's many Christmases spent with mystery author Ruth Rendell, famed writer, member of the British House of Lords? The whys, the hows of those Christmases in a chapter she has entitled Ruth Rendell's Red Cabbage. We met, our author says, because she needed someone to house-sit while she went on a tour of Australia for 6 weeks. I was writing my second novel. With her characteristic thoughtfulness for young writers, Ruth Rendell said that she, too, was writing a second novel as Barbara Vine, the pen name she had recently assumed for thrillers of terrifying psychological insight. Ruth and I came to really like each other. In some ways, it was as simple as that. Over the years, we started our own tradition of spending Christmas Day or Boxing Day together. Her son lives in America, and after her husband Don died, our Christmas time became more important to both of us. The routine was always the same. She told me when to arrive so that we could go for a long walk around London. She planned the route. There was always something she wanted to see. Her later work is full of London. She loved walking in London, and Christmas Day is quiet. After the walk, we'd eat. Ruth cooked. She was a nimble cook. No fuss. She wasn't all that interested in food, but she liked making Christmas dinner. What did we have? Pheasant, roast potatoes, carrots, a green vegetable of some sort, usually whatever I had grown in the garden that had survived slugs and pigeons. So we might eat sprouts if we were lucky, kale if we weren't. Lots of gravy. And this is the point of the story, Ruth Rendell's pickled red cabbage. Ruth made the pickled cabbage in early autumn. She always rang me to tell me on the day. Oh, Jeanette, it's Ruth. I'm picking the cabbage, and then I'll walk down to the house. She meant the House of Lords, where she was a labor peer. It's not generally known that Ruth was a big country and western fan, so the cabbage pickling was accompanied by Tammy Wynette, or K.D. Lang. I was never present at the process of pickling. Ruth was her own alchemist, and whatever she did it better than me. I have her recipe, but not her knack. Pickling was something that Ruth's generation of women understood. She was born in 1930. When her husband was alive, she pickled him gherkins. He loved a gherkin. She told me she had pickled rabbits during the war. What did they taste like? How should I know? It looked disgusting. I wasn't going to eat it, Jeanette. And then that laugh. Ruth had a wonderful laugh, directed at the comedy of life, its absurdity. It's fair to say Ruth Rendell was a connoisseur of the pickle. She loved a pickled herring. I adore pickled cucumber, and I always order it when I eat at the Woolsey restaurant on Piccadilly in London. Ruth liked to take me there. Generally in life, Ruth found herself paying the bill. She was both wealthy and generous, so it was good for her to be taken out. And our rule was that she never paid at the Woolsey. I always got there first so that I could order champagne without having a fight. I find the champagne and pickled cucumber is an excellent combination. Ruth, though, never thought much of the Woolsey cucumber. Mine's much better, you know. And it was. After our meal, it was TV time. Ruth was in charge of what we watched on Christmas, but it had to be something scheduled in real time. No DVDs, no catch-up TV. Ruth put her feet up on the sofa with her beloved cat, Archie. I'd lie on the other sofa, and we'd complain about the telly. It was important to be able to complain about the telly. About 10 o'clock, Ruth would zap the zapper and say, "I can't stand any more of this rubbish. Can you?" It was not a question. Then she followed it with a second non-question. "Shall we have the Christmas pudding?" The pudding, always made by a friend of hers in the House of Lords, was the size of a cannonball and just as heavy. It was a lethal weapon disguised as dessert. Ruth let it boil for hours, wrapped in a rag in a double pan the old-fashioned way. When the pudding was thought to be ready, and Ruth, the most precise of persons, never used a timer, she set about making custard. While this was happening, she'd sing a bit, usually country and western, or sometimes Handel. She was a big Handel fan. Sometimes it was Jolene, melodied with Hits from the Messiah. The custard was proper homemade with milk and eggs. The effort had to be encouraged by opening a further bottle of champagne. But only half. Then the pudding was tipped into the dish, covered in brandy by me and set alight by Ruth. Ruth always said she was too full to eat any, and then munched her way through exactly one half. The next day, she'd send me home with the rest of the jar of red cabbage. The last Christmas I spent with her was 2014. Ruth Rendell had a stroke on January 7th, 2015, and never recovered. I miss our Christmases together. And the red cabbage. Here's her recipe. And indeed, you get a recipe for Ruth Rendell's red cabbage. Well, there are 9 more tales of Christmas here, some true, some maybe not, all worth a few minutes of your time. If you're looking for a book with stories that are just a little different this Christmastide, a book that will shake you out of your not another sweater reverie, and offer you a recipe for holiday fish, too. This is a book from sea-coasted Great Britain, after all. I offer you Christmas Days, 12 stories and 12 feasts for 12 days. Read it and weep. Read it and smile. Let's finish with Winterson's own closing lines to this wonderful book of Christmas stories. Sometimes the thing we long for, the thing we need, the miracle we want is right there in front of us, and we can't see it. We run the other way, or saddest of all, we just don't know what to do with it. Think how many people get the success they want, the partner they want, the money they want, etc., and turn it into dust and ashes, like the fairy gold no one can spend. So at Christmas, I think about the Christmas story and all the Christmas stories since. As a writer, I know we get along badly without space in our lives for imagination, for reflection. Religious festivals were designed to be time outside of time, time where ordinary time was subject to significant time, what we remember, what we invent. So light a candle to the dead, and light a candle to miracles, however unlikely, and pray that you recognize yours. And light a candle to the living, the world of friendship and family that means so much. And light a candle to the future, that it may happen and not be swallowed up by darkness. And light a candle to love, lucky love. Christmas Days by Jeanette Winterson. It's one of those Christmas books that I think I will come to treasure, and I hope you do too. It's available at the West Lafayette Public Library.